You're tuned to The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. So, Senator Ted Cruz spoke at the Republican convention last night, and as you might have heard, he was roundly booed when he refused to endorse Donald Trump.
To those listening, please, don't stay home in November. If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Now, most of Washington State's delegates are Cruz supporters, including Mark Perez from Puyallup. He defended Ted Cruz's speech because Perez thinks Trump isn't even a Republican.
You know, just because you're in a garage doesn't mean you're a Porsche. You can wear a Porsche t-shirt, but you're not a Porsche, you know. And so Donald Trump is a populist. Donald Trump is his own man. And so if you don't stand on a platform, there's no entitlement for an endorsement.
That was Delegate Mark Perez. Now, KUOW's David Hyde is at the convention in Cleveland. He told me Ted Cruz's speech deepened the divide within Washington State's Republican Party, the divide we've been talking about all week. And he says the language Cruz used was especially interesting.
Ted Cruz told delegates to vote your conscience, and that's the exact same language that delegates I've been speaking with have been using all week. That's what they wanted to do in this Free the Delegates movement. So they, of course, were thrilled that Ted Cruz was so with them, but state GOP chairman Susan Hutchinson had the opposite reaction.
He was standing there talking with his people, and I just walked up and I introduced myself and identified myself as chairman of the Washington State Republican Party. And I said that I thought what he did was inexcusable and that he was a traitor to the party. For all the hard work that each delegation has made together, he slapped us in the face.
So Susan Hutchinson is calling Ted Cruz essentially a traitor to the party. I mean, this is pretty extraordinary. How big of a deal was this, do you think, that she confronted him in this way?
Yeah, calling Ted Cruz a traitor to his face, even in the heat of the moment, when so many Washington state delegates are with Ted Cruz, says to me that the Republican Party in Washington State is in a really fragile place right now. And delegates say to me that there are at least five different factions. You've got the moderates who kind of yearn for the good old days. You've got the evangelical wing, the Tea Party wing, the neocons who are mostly concerned with foreign policy. And there are also now more kind of libertarian-leaning Republicans. Obviously, there's going to be some overlap there, but the point here is that there's some profound disagreement about what really matters, about what is the Republican Party.
Well, we knew going into this convention that there was going to be a lot of disagreement because a lot of these folks were Ted Cruz supporters. But we spoke to Susan Hutchinson yesterday, and she said that over the course of the week, she's seen these delegates come together. And she felt that, you know, she was hopeful because she saw people sort of starting to coalesce behind Donald Trump. What do you think about that? Do you think that's true? Have you seen that yourself?
Yes, yeah, some of the delegates that I spoke with told me that they started out Cruz supporters and they've become Trump supporters either over the course of this convention or they had made up their minds earlier. The anti-Trump forces say they still outnumber the number of folks who have done that. So they say that this Ted Cruz, never Trump coalition is still, you know, partly intact.
So when you talk about the divisions within the party, how significant do you think this is going to be going forward? I mean, given that, you know, even though this is sort of party infighting, Donald Trump did win pretty significantly in the state in the Republican primary. I mean, he won with more than 70% of the vote. So does it really matter, you know, how much party insiders are fighting right now in terms of what might happen in November?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think it's a kind of a reality check. I mean, you know, Chairman Susan Hutchinson is really stressed out right now. That's pretty obvious. And so is the GOP nationally. They were not happy with Ted Cruz last night. But if you put it back in perspective in Washington State, there's a never Trump movement on the part of party activists, on the part of kind of hardcore conservatives. But is there a never Bill Bryant movement? You know, he's the Republican running against Governor Jay Inslee. I haven't heard about that yet.
So even if this doesn't trickle down to the statewide or the local candidates, what is it that precipitated this whole crisis and this division within the party?
Donald Trump. The anti-Trump delegates that I spoke with, some of them don't believe he's a Republican. And not only that, some of them think that he's got a secret pact with the Democratic Party.
Certainly watching this convention has been incredible. It's been amazing drama, especially last night. I know one of the things that you were looking for when you arrived in Cleveland was, you know, whether there were going to be a lot of protests outside of the arena. But it sounded like they haven't been as intense as people were expecting. What was your experience covering these protests?
Yeah, my family wasn't super excited about me coming to this convention, especially given some of the news in recent weeks. But I've spent a fair amount of time at Cleveland's public square where there are a lot of police. In fact, I'm staying at Case Western Reserve University, and there are police officers all over here. I think there's something like 1,900 staying here. But things have been relatively calm. I'm going to say I think these have been some of the most boring protests in American history. You know, which people in Cleveland are really happy about.
Well, that's great. I mean, have you gotten around the city? Have you met a lot of Clevelanders? And what sense do you get from them about the convention?
Yeah, I have to say, everyone here is incredibly warm. They're incredibly welcoming, which is kind of amazing because this is a Democratic town. I mean, it's a Republican state, but Cleveland is a Democratic town, but they welcome the Republican National Committee here. And what people tell me, and they all tell me the same story, which is that Cleveland was really down about, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. At the height of the recession, this city was in pretty bad shape. And they've come back. They've come back a long way economically, financially. There are more jobs now than there were back then. And they just won the NBA Finals. And now a national convention is here. And so they feel like this is shedding light on kind of how far their city's come and perhaps where it's going. So that's just been a great experience to talk to people here in Cleveland, because they're just so warm and nice and have that kind of Midwestern charm.
That's KUOW's David Hyde. He was speaking to me from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Tonight, Donald Trump will officially accept the party's presidential nomination. We'll bring that to you live. Next week, the Democratic National Convention will kick off in Philadelphia. KUOW will be there to bring you stories from Washington state delegates. This is The Record on KUOW. Leslie Jones is an African-American comedian and one of the Ghostbusters in the all-female reboot of that movie. And you might have heard that earlier this week, some of her detractors took to their keyboards to attack her on Twitter. They hurled racial slurs, compared her to an ape. They sent her pornographic images. Leslie Jones fought back, but when the abuse became too overwhelming, she quit Twitter. That's something that local writer Ijeomu Olowu has experienced as well. She says the online abuse directed at women of color in particular is usually an organized campaign.
Every day there's something. You will get something every single day. You will get a message about, you know, why are you all on welfare? You know, you should all be in prison or you should still be slaves. And those you actually kind of brush off. Usually every other day or so, there's a death threat of some sort. And you brush those off. But what happens then is your name will pop up in a Reddit thread or on some obscure website. And suddenly you have dozens at a time of, you know, images of dead bodies, rape threats, racial slurs. And it's nonstop. And the goal is to really overwhelm you and make it so that you can't enjoy anything on Twitter and you can't get your message out because you're too busy defending yourselves from these people.
How does that affect you?
You know, it weighs on you. And sometimes at first you don't realize how much it is and it kind of builds up. When we look at like these last couple of years, when we talk about things like Black Lives Matter and we're talking about these really sensitive subjects where people are, you know, dead in the streets, and then you get messages repeatedly reminding you that people think that you should be dead too. And, you see this time and time again, and you're already raw, you're already hurting, you're already wondering if your kids are safe, and then you get messages from people saying that everyone that looks like you should be killed, or that they're glad that these kids are dead, and you should be next, or you should have never been alive in the first place. It weighs on you, and you start, you know, you get this pit in your stomach when you log on, because you have to see the good things that are being said, and you have to see that your word is getting out there and that your work is getting out there, but you don't know what comment's coming next. And you'll get a comment that says, great, I love this article. And then the next comment will be, I hope you die. And, you know, it's a gut punch. And eventually you get so tired, you get so weary. You start to forget that the world is a better place. You start to forget that it's not filled with hate. And that's what they want. They want you to really believe that everyone hates you. They hate you because of the color of your skin. They hate you because of your gender or your sexual orientation. They want you to believe that you are not safe anywhere. And you really start to feel it. You get so tired. You get really wary. I mean, there are times where I don't want to see anyone. When I spend all day getting messages of hate from strangers, and then someone says, hey, do you want to go to a party? And I'm like, more strangers? Oh, no, I don't want to go anywhere. And you do. You stop going out. And I have a lot of other Black women on Twitter who've said the same thing to me. They're like, I don't go anywhere anymore because all I get is hate from people. And I know somewhere inside that when I go to this party, someone's not going to walk up to me and shout the N-word at me. But it just makes me not want to be around people.
So what is your response to that? I mean, what do you do in reaction?
I report everything I can on a regular basis in the hopes that maybe one day it will be taken seriously and so that other people don't have to suffer the same abuse. It depends on my mood. If I can just block people, I will block them. If I want to try and make light of it so I don't feel so constantly beat down by it, I will try that. But when you have dozens of these, there's really no way you can react that's going to mitigate the situation. So, you know, for me, it's hard. My work is on Twitter. I can't avoid it. Without it, I wouldn't have a career. I have, you know, 27,000 followers. It's where I get most of my writing out. It's where I flesh out ideas. It's where I find out what's happening in the world and have really important conversations. So oftentimes I have to make a choice. Do I take a couple of days off and miss important stories that I could be writing about, miss important conversations I could be having, miss the opportunity to get my articles out there to my audience? Or do I come and suffer this abuse in the meantime? And that's a decision that so many public figures on there who really do rely upon it for their jobs have to do. And when we talk about women of color, LGBT people, disabled people, these are people who don't have as regular access to mainstream media as other people do. And so oftentimes, this is the only place they can, you know, get their voice out there and be heard. And I think that's why we often are targets. It's because people know that this is important to us. And they know that we are being heard on this platform. And they want to make sure that we are paying this horrible tax in order to be heard. So I'm hoping, while we still have this platform that can do so many great things for voices that normally aren't heard, that these platforms will take notice and make real, concrete, lasting change to the way in which they protect people from hate speech on these platforms.
Do you see a way to do that, though? I mean, given that, you know, Twitter has millions of users, and as you say, this is a fairly widespread problem. How do these social media platforms control the folks who are using them? And isn't there a kind of question about, you know, this is the internet, it's supposed to be free. How do you crack down on speech in a way that that doesn't crack down on free speech?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I know that a lot of people are concerned about this, but Twitter and Facebook and all of these platforms have terms of service that everyone who signs up for these platforms agrees to. And in these platforms, you're not supposed to be able to send racial slurs, rape threats, death threats. You're not supposed to organize harassment campaigns against people on these platforms. So they are in direct violation of the rules that were already set forth. You know, this should be automated for a lot of this. There are words that you can easily flag. So if someone reports someone said the N-word to me, they should be able to do a quick scan and say, oh, there it is. And, you know, here's your first warning. Maybe second one's a suspension. Third one, you are no longer allowed on the platform or something like that. But it should be fairly easy. I mean, they are able to flag for copyright infringement all the time. I mean, if you want to have a post removed or be suspended, try putting up a copyrighted video and that'll happen instantly. So if they can find that, but they can't find people shouting, you know, the N-word at people by the dozens, you know, that kind of makes me wonder what they're doing with their time. Right now, the onus is completely on the person being abused on these platforms. So when you report a comment for hate or for anything, you have to, you know, say what the problem is. You click through all of these boxes. Then you get an email saying, please clarify exactly again what happened. So if you're getting 30, 40, 50 of these a day, you're having to reply back with an email, find those original tweets, state what happened. And then time and time again, they go, we've reviewed this and it doesn't violate our terms of service. I've literally had dead corpses, pictures of dead corpses sent to me. And the response I get back is this doesn't violate terms of service. So if they're going to say that they're doing it, if they say they're going to review it, if they're going to make us go through all that work, a cursory glance, anybody with eyes could see that these are threats, that these are violations of the terms of service. And all that I want and all that many people on these platforms want is just them to enforce the rules that we've all already agreed to.
Do you ever have people say to you, hey, look, this is the price you pay for being on the internet, for having all the good things that you get? You just have to develop a tougher skin, you know, just thicker skin, put up with it.
You know, I would say we should never put the onus on the abused to accept abuse. Like, we can't continuously adjust to hate. We can't. Why would we want to acclimate to hate? Why would we want to live in a world where we shrug off violence, where we shrug off death threats and rape threats? I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to wake up one day and go, you know, somebody hopes I get raped today. I don't ever want to feel like that's okay, because it's not okay. And this does contribute to an environment where we are telling our kids that it's okay. And the line between what's a joke, what's a prank, and what's real is more and more blurred every single day. So to say, just brush it off, I mean, chances are if you're saying that, you are not someone who has to face it on a regular basis. I'm usually hearing this from people who, you know, at most someone calls them a jerk if they don't like something they say online, because they don't happen to belong to a group that can make an easy target for these sorts of slurs and this sort of violence. But I don't want anyone to ever be okay with these sort of attacks, because once we say that it's okay, it's just a small step for the action to actually be okay.
Ijeoma Oluo is a Seattle writer and editor-at-large of the online magazine The Establishment. She wrote an article in The Guardian about the online abuse that caused actress Leslie Jones to leave Twitter. We're tweeting out a link to that piece now. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong. We're going to talk more about the upcoming primary election. Ballots are out, and you have until 8 p.m. on Tuesday, August 2nd, to return yours. In Seattle, voters are being asked to decide the future of the city's waterfront. It's called Initiative 123. A yes vote means the city will build a mile-long, car-free, elevated park along Alaskan Way. It will preserve a 400-foot chunk of the viaduct and those much-loved views of Elliott Bay and the Olympic Mountains. Opponents say it will kill plans that are already underway for the waterfront, plans they've been working on for years. So to help you decide how to vote, we brought in Kate Martin to argue for Initiative 123 and Patrick Gordon to make the case against it. We started with Kate Martin.
I-123 is a way to improve the downtown waterfront plan by adding a component that just changes everything for the better. It's integrating a mile-long elevated park on a brand-new garden bridge into the plan so that we can have a glorious open space with panoramic 360-degree views for all to enjoy forever.
And how does this involve the viaduct?
The view from the viaduct is the inspiration, although it's not really a part of the plan. We did a feasibility study in 2014. Borough Happel did that and determined that the best way to go about this was a brand-new garden bridge although we keep a little sliver of the viaduct so that we have a story to tell and a glimpse of the past.
All right, what is a garden bridge? I mean, how could you just paint a picture? What would this look like?
It would be a park that's elevated is basically what a garden bridge is. It would be just a lovely, verdant place with no cars, very accessible flat park with a grand gateway from Union Street downtown. And it would be a place like Green Lake or Seward Park where we go to meet with our friends, walk and talk, gather with friends and family, get some exercise, walk the dog, ride your bike, and enjoy those fabulous views that we've enjoyed for 60 years.
All right. So, Patrick, you are part of the No on I-123 campaign. What do you not like about this idea?
Well, I have a number of things I don't like about it. The first of which is it ignores what has been a 15-year effort on the part of a lot of us. And, you know, in what is, I think, one of the really unusual circumstances in politics in this community is that the state, the county, the city, the port, private business, different interest groups got together and forged an agreement for the waterfront that both accommodated a necessity of replacing Highway 99, accommodating north-south traffic along Alaskan Way, providing an opportunity for the city to come in and rebuild the seawall and to create a park. So it's been a very long process. It's been a long process that involved thousands of people, literally, hundreds of meetings. So my big objection is that after all of this work, after millions of dollars of money that has been spent developing a spectacular plan, that this initiative comes along, poorly written, that opens the checkbook of the city's general fund for a plan that doesn't exist to now alter our course and, I think, scuttle the entire plan that's been so long in the making.
So, Kate, what do you say in response to that? This has been a multi-year process, hundreds of hours of planning, probably millions of dollars spent on the planning as well, a really complex project with the viaduct going down, the tunnel, everything, the seawall. How can you come in at the last minute and sort of change things up like this? Isn't that a sort of a dangerous proposition?
The dangerous proposition is to keep moving forward on the SDOT plan. It has about 10 major glitches in it that we should never build. This is our opportunity to pivot to a plan that has public benefit, adds tremendous beauty and value, will attract people year-round. It's not a commercial space. It doesn't have ferry traffic cutting through it. It doesn't have service driveways cutting through it. It doesn't have any of the noise. Most of the really great things about the SDOT plan remain, but the problematic things are improved. Our best asset down there is the fabulous view that's available at 55 feet above Alaskan Way. So by elevating the park, we're putting our best feature forward, and we are creating something for downtown that will pay us back in spades. These are not spaces that are going to get neglected and fall into disrepair and not really be programmed or used. This is the kind of space that will naturally attract users. Visitors, locals, everyone will flock there because it will be the greatest thing that ever happened to our downtown. But no one has been able to identify a public benefit for the people of Seattle in the SDOT plan.
So it sounds like Kate not only likes the elevated walkway, but doesn't like your plan that you guys have come up with.
I would agree with the fact that it sounds like she doesn't. All of the attributes that Kate went on about exist in the plan. And you can be pragmatic about it and say, you know, the operations and her concern that people won't go there. We have spent years talking about the programming, planning, operations, maintenance of the plan. There is a budget in place to do that. We have talked at length about an art plan that goes into it. We have talked at length about funding and have a plan in place and isn't being implemented as we talk. We have, obviously, the design, all with public input. She talked about downtown will love it. Downtown will love the fact that the wall between downtown and its waterfront is gone, and they've said so. DSA is a major supporter of the waterfront and in opposition to 123. The AIA has spent years studying the waterfront and the opposes 123. The Stranger, The Times, we've got a coalition of folks that you would never see together normally coming at it and supporting the No on 123 plan because, in fact, it does have significant public engagement behind it. It has thousands of hours of engagement, and it has millions of dollars of design that have gone into it.
So I want to just say that tremendous outreach does not equal wonderful outcomes on a project. It's part of the process that has to happen. Let me just break this down a little bit. The conventional wisdom that says when we take that viaduct down, we're going to get ourselves a world-class waterfront is just not true. It's not Alki down there. We're talking about not a water's edge. We're talking about touristy buildings on the piers where there is no water's edge and an incredibly busy roadway that is going to get busier and busier when that tunnel is built and the viaduct comes down. It's just not the kind of context you would build off of. We'll still have a great boardwalk along the piers. That'll be fun for people that want to feed seagulls French fries or buy shrunken heads at the ye olde curiosity shop. They can still do that. But to have a glorious open space that has none of that commercial aspect to it. And additionally, this park is going to be perfectly flat and accessible to all users. What we're offered in the SDOT plan is the freight route promenade and a very, very, very long viewing ramp from the market to Alaskan Way that so many people will not be able to use. You just have to have a space where everybody is welcome to it and everybody is welcome to a very flat park where we can literally play. It's not a place where we go visit a view. It's a place that we just go use and we use it again and we use it again, just like we do these other fabulous promenades in Seattle.
Patrick, do you want to respond to that?
Where do I start? A couple of things. Kate mentioned that every city in the world is looking at building elevated structures. I would direct you to shoreline and waterfront parks. You know, go to San Francisco, go to Montreal, go to Toronto. There's so many places, Baltimore, where cities have basically reclaimed their waterfronts that had the imposition of kind of the post-industrial transportation systems put on top of those. So Seattle is late in coming to the game on this, but we're going to reclaim that magical threshold between the downtown and the waterfront. From the standpoint of thinking about, you know, the flat, inaccessible park, one of the things that we set out early on in developing the guiding principles for the park was that it was going to be a waterfront for all. And all includes making it a genuine waterfront, a working waterfront, accommodating both people who live, work, play on the waterfront with people who have to use it for commerce, for people who have to use it for transportation, all of which brings activity to the waterfront and brings vibrancy and doesn't require somebody to go up onto an elevated deck and have the one experience that they can get, which is the view, and miss all of the other experiences that happen along the waterfront, mixing with people and enjoying everything from the day-to-day activities to the tourist activities. So, you know, I think it's a fundamental difference between a view and an experience. And what we're offering is a park that is full of the experiences.
People already have their ballots in hand. They're probably filling them out this week. Given that a lot of people aren't really paying very close attention, what's your final argument to voters right now about why this should be a yes on I-123 or a no? Kate, why don't we start with you?
This is our 100-year gesture. The 15 years ago, when these interests got together and made their plan ideas, elevated parks had not really come onto the stage. We know too much at this point to ignore that we would have the most fabulous elevated park in the world. It would change our city and give us a romantic edge and a place for the people to enjoy forever. This is our chance. It doesn't cost more. It's still a City of Seattle project. It's a plan improvement that we must make to bring this wonderful asset, this wonderful elevated park to our city.
Patrick?
I would ask people to go to waterfrontseattle.org and look at the plan that's in there and compare it to Kate's plan, if it exists, because it doesn't exist within the ordinance or within the website that they have, and compare the opportunities that exist. And we talk about a 100-year plan. This is a city-changing opportunity that is a product of a tremendous amount of collaboration between a huge variety of interest groups and stakeholders and public input. The idea that an elevated park on a waterfront is a tremendous space is pure folly. We talk a lot about the High Line. I love the High Line. Jim Corner, who designed the High Line, is the designer of the Central Waterfront Plan for Seattle. The High Line is in a different context completely. It winds its way through what was a very troubled neighborhood, not near the water, not on the waterfront. It is virtually the inverse of the Seattle waterfront opportunity that we have, which is to take down the structure and engage the waterfront at the street level. So go to the website, look at the plan, and see if all of the wonderful things that Kate ascribes to hers don't really exist in our plan.
That's Patrick Gordon. He's an architect with the No on I-123 campaign. We also heard from Kate Martin. She's a city planner and the author of the Yes on I-123 campaign. They were talking about whether or not Seattle should have an elevated park along its downtown waterfront. Seattle voters get to vote on that, and ballots are due August 2nd. Did you ever see the musical Billy Elliot? It's about a young boy who dreams of becoming a ballet dancer. Well, it turns out Seattle has its own real-life Billy Elliot. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman introduces us to him.
Hello, my name is Philip Constantine Nicholas Magna, and I'm a male ballet dancer training at Pacific Northwest Ballet.
This 13-year-old Seattleite has been dancing for most of his life, ever since he was 4 years old.
And I got into it because my sister was actually started dancing at Pacific Northwest Ballet. And being the younger sibling of us two, I wanted to do exactly what she did.
At the PNB school, girls outnumber boys almost 5-1. Philip didn't mind, but it caused him some problems outside the ballet company.
There used to be a lot of teasing that I was a dancer and that I had a tutu on and that I was a little girlish dancer.
Sometimes the teasing got to him, but whenever Philip danced, he knew this was what he was meant to do.
The love that I got for it was when we stopped doing all of the at-the-bar work with the technique, and we went to the floor, and that's where I really thrived with the movement and expressing it.
And expressing himself. This summer, Philip was cast as the lead in a local production of Billy Elliot. The fictional Billy dreams of a career at London's Royal Ballet. Philip knows exactly how that feels.
My biggest dream is to go to New York City Ballet and dance there on the big stage.
With focus and hard work, Philip Mergener believes his dreams can come true. From Queen Anne Hill, that's The Art of Our City. I'm Marcy Silman.
I was dancing when I was 12. I was dancing when I was 12.
And you can see pictures of Philip at our website, kuow.org. You can find all of Marcy's art stories there as well. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke, and we're live tweeting at KUOW. This month, we've seen two more high-profile killings of black men at the hands of police and shootings of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge. Those killings were part of what prompted Eula Scott Bino to organize a public discussion with white people about race. Eula is one of three co-hosts of the podcast Hella Black, Hella Seattle. This Sunday on Capitol Hill, she'll be bringing together a group of black people and a group of white people to talk about race on stage. The group will include her friend Alyssa Wehrman, who's white. I asked Alyssa what her response was when Eula asked her to be part of a public event about race and racism.
What was my reaction? It was pretty, I was surprised.
Yeah.
I definitely had to pause and just say, wow, and really take in the enormity of what you were asking me. You know, and see, like, wow, is this something that I'm capable of doing? Well, whatever, I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, it wasn't I think just sort of having to step back and sort of say, like, okay, something needs to happen.
Yeah.
And I have a place in this.
Yeah.
I am a white person. I have a place in this. I have a lot of power. I have a lot of privilege that the conversation needs to be shifted. And I recognize that I am a part of this and that my liberation is entwined with yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have it all figured out.
Yeah. Me either.
No way. And if I can be, if I can go up there and make some huge guffaws, you know, and just show people that, okay, I'm going to still sit here, you know,
yeah.
like that'll probably do better than if I go up there and I act like I got it all together and I know exactly what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
you know, I almost want to make mistakes so that somebody can like check me.
Yeah.
So that I can be like, hey, look, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah.
And we're going to go out afterwards and have some biscuits. Like,
yeah.
it's
yeah.
okay.
No, so true. This is a quick short story, but this just plays into it.
This is going to be quick.
My preschool teacher and I are very close. And the other day I'm walking through the house and my mom says to me, have you talked to her for, you know, Fran? And I said, no, what's up? And she was like, well, I haven't talked to her in a while. I feel like she's mad at me. And I was like, oh, what happened? And she was like, I don't know. She said something white and privileged. And I called her on it. And so she hasn't talked to me for a couple of months. And I was like, oh, man, are you guys really beefing? And my mom was like, no, this happens all the time. We've been friends for 30-something years. Mm-hmm. There are moments where we're going to have to... I have to call her out on these problems. She has to take it in, mm-hmm. decide whether or not I was just being, you know, too Beverly or super right. And then she comes back and we're best friends again. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a big part of it, too, recognizing that we can come back from these kinds of conversations and yeah. still love each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's a question for both of you. Why do you think it is so hard to have conversations, open conversations about race? Why is that so hard for us?
It's not hard for me.
I was going to say, it's probably not hard for
you. I talk about
you.
Race all the time. I tell people that I was raised in a household. My parents were social rights activists and workers' rights activists. And so they constantly had meetings. And the meetings were not just black people. The meetings were of all backgrounds. And they talked all the time about problems in this country. And so for me, it's as natural as like talking about coffee. And it's also as clear to me as talking mm-hmm. about coffee. I'm kind of surprised when people are like, I didn't see that or I didn't feel that. Because mm-hmm. I'm almost like, oh, I see it. All I do is see it.
Yeah.
And so I bring it up pretty much 15 minutes after meeting anyone.
Mm-hmm. Alyssa, how about you? Is it comfortable, uncomfortable to talk about race?
Well, I think it depends on who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
But it's an internal dialogue that goes on in my head every day, you know. I mean, I'm constantly noticing things. I'm constantly talking about things. My family will tell you that, you know, I'm always bringing up something or interrupting or just asking a question. Why did you say that? Or, you know, hey, my son and I talk about this. So with certain people, it's not uncomfortable, but I need to work on the people that it's uncomfortable to talk about.
Eula, are you hoping that this event will be kind of a way to model these conversations? You know, because it is some of these things are difficult for people to hear. When you talk about directness, you know, people often can bristle when they feel attacked or right. And that's not necessarily the most mm-hmm. effective way to carry on a conversation. So are you hoping to model better ways of getting those points across?
I'm hoping people walk away with tools on how to talk to each other. So, yeah, I hope that they walk away with how to better have this conversation and what a conversation looks like and feels like. Honestly, you can't give a person like a script for these kinds of things because they don't know what they're walking into. But I think people need to understand the value of their conversation. One of the big reasons why this came to my mind was because I was at a wedding when everything happened. Like during the two killings, I was in Oakland for my cousin's wedding. And my cousin and her partner are both POC, but their larger community is largely white. And I kind of magnetize people that want to talk about race. Also, well, all brown people do when they're in white spaces, right? The white people are just like, I don't have anything else to talk to you besides the black things I know. Mm. And so this one woman was saying how she has she really wants to move to the east, to the West Coast. She because all of their people are from the East. And she really likes how diverse it is and how communicating everyone is and how accepting and loving and how she was raised super left. Her dad is like all the way left, progressive. But he says things that she's had to, like, you know, cringe at. And she thought to herself, like, my dad is kind of is racist, right? And so she said she doesn't really talk to him. And I was like, that doesn't help me. Mm-hmm. You not talking to this dude is the opposite of what I need you to do. You cutting him off and moving to the West Coast and living your super liberal life and then still going home for holidays and calling him when you need money is not going to help me. What would help me is if you talk to him all the time. Hard conversations, fun conversations, realizing that he's not completely wrong in every facet just because he makes mistakes sometimes. We are all, like, undoing all that we've learned for 600 years. And so I think we have to give people a break sometimes. The same way Black people have been learned to be kind of accepting of what they've been given. I think that white people have been taught that we are less than. And so we've got to have this huge, you know, fix where it goes, talk about it, figure it out. The same way we're, like, reteaching all of our community, you have value, you have worth, you can be something, all this Black girl magic, all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. White people have to start saying, like, cool, I think that I have some issues. I got to work those out. I got to talk to myself. I got to talk to my friends. I've talked to my family.
So, Alyssa, when you want to then start a conversation about race with other folks in your life, how do you start it? I mean, how do you bring this up?
So, I mean, I think I don't know. It depends on who I'm talking to, but, like, specifically, I am going to just say it out loud because I need to do it. I need to talk with my parents. I was raised in a household with a police officer, I want to know how they feel about, you know, the most recent killings, but in general, police and their attitudes towards Black people. I want to know.
You haven't had this conversation yet?
No, I haven't. Because it goes... It goes, I mean, the power that was just inherently in the household that I grew up in is, you know, I don't know what that feels like to be a Black person, you know, policed in the world. But I know what that power feels like, you know. There was always just this separation. I've definitely had interactions with police officers as a white woman. I'm a petite person. I navigate spaces very easily, you know, all of these things. So I feel like I can have that conversation with my parents. How am I going to start it? I'm going to start it by talking with my mom in an email, probably saying, hey, let's talk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to get a little more specific and say, hey, yeah, I was wondering if maybe we could talk about some of the recent news events. Yeah. And then the next time I write her, I might be like, oh, yeah, hey, sometimes maybe I wonder, you know, I'm just kind of curious about, you know, so-and-so's not in the police department anymore. Like, let's talk about, like, how do y'all feel about this? Maybe sometime. Mm-hmm. And, like, let them go and, like, have a talk about it and get it out.
Yeah.
And then, like, actually have a talk, you know?
Yeah.
So that I'm not taking her by surprise, so that there can't be that, like, defensive. There's definitely this, like, verboten, like, I don't talk about politics in my family. I don't talk about religion. I don't talk about, like, police. Like, there's that kind of understood thing that I grew up with. And I mean, I'm 42 years old. I can say,
yeah,
I'm a part of this family and I'm calling you into this conversation.
Yeah.
You know, past that point, I mean, I haven't ever really pushed on doing that. And if it really doesn't work or go anywhere after numerous attempts, I don't know what to do after that, but I don't know. I mean, like, maybe it would have an amazing impact.
Yeah.
You know?
It's worth trying.
Absolutely.
But it also brings up, I mean, just watching your face and the emotion that you have, it also brings up that these issues can bring up so much more than just whatever is being talked about, right? There's a lot of baggage that all of us carry about these things that make it really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not just this issue that we would be calling in all sorts of demons and ghosts from the past.
Yeah. Could be good.
Which is more important to talk about that mm-hmm. if it's going to help
yeah.
Black people not getting killed.
Yeah. Well, it's more important. If it's going to help your own sense of well-being as
well. I'm not sure that it would. I mean, it might compromise my relationship, but if it's right, that's just what needs to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, too, that whole thing where, we talk about our family, and I think that this, what I'm hearing from this and thinking is that family is where we have to start, right? Because I hear when people say things like, oh, I posted something online and I lost a handful of followers and I'm okay with that. Those are people you mm-hmm. didn't even know anyways. Like, Facebook's not a real world. We've talked about this.
Man.
And so, but you can't unfollow your mom, your dad, your cousins, your partner, perhaps, and your kids. So those are the people that you need to have these conversations with. So I'm hoping that.
Yeah, and we have access to that.
Yeah.
I have access to people that you don't have access to, that Black people don't have access
absolutely.
To. These corners and these crevices where I can go and I can reach people.
Yeah.
I have to use that.
Yeah.
That was Alyssa Wehrman and Eula Scott Bynoe. They'll be talking about race and racism at a panel conversation this Sunday on Capitol Hill in Seattle from 4 to 5. It's part of the Bad Will Market pop-up. We're tweeting out a link to the event now, and we'll give you all the details. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. This is The Record on KUOW. All right, music lovers, the Capitol Hill Block Party gets started tomorrow, and it's the 20-year anniversary of the three-day music festival. Seattle DJ Marco Collins is excited about it. He told Bill Radke there are some can't-miss local bands playing this weekend.
The thing that I love about the Block Party is that it's not just national names. I'd say at least half the lineup are local bands. And to me, that's exciting when a festival embraces the local scene as strong as Block Party does, or like last weekend's Timber Festival. That was almost all local bands. Some really great festivals in this town that you wouldn't get anywhere else.
There's a local band headlining the main stage, Odessa.
Yeah, the biggest Seattle band that nobody knows about. They're an EDM electronic group, a couple of guys from Bellingham, and this is actually their second full-length record. They started in 2012. It's a very cinematic sound. It is very much a part of that EDM culture, but it's fantastic. I recently read an article that they were talking about how quickly the live shows have grown, and not just in Seattle, but all over the world. These guys are world known, and they played 3 sold-out shows at the Paramount last time they were here, and still, nobody talks about them. It's not like you read articles about them being the next big thing, and they already are.
Why do you think they're not getting the pub you'd expect from packing the Paramount?
I don't know, because I think that the appeal is a very youthful appeal, and the folks writing the stories and reporting the news aren't exactly plugged into youth culture anymore. We're more focused on how big Macklemore's gotten than, this group that's taken the world by storm.
Okay, that's Odessa headlining the main stage at the Capitol Hill Block Party. And you want to play us another sound. This is Iska Daf.
Yeah, this is another duo that I just am in love with. They put out, I believe this is their second full-length record. They celebrated the release of this record at the Crocodile, and this is a track called Invisible Cities.
Their website says the new album takes the complications of loss, depression, and instability from the bandmates' personal lives and uses it as fuel.
Yeah, it's funny. When you meet these guys, you would never think in a million years that they would be writing sort of the dark content lyrically on this record. They're just the nicest, most upbeat guys. And then you listen to this record. And it's interesting to me because they're all over the place in terms of styles, too. One minute they'll put out this strange punk rock song, and then the rest of it, there's definitely pop structure to what they do. There's hooks for days with Iska Daf.
Tell me more about Iska Daff.
Couple of guys from here in Seattle. They've both been in many other bands, but this combination is sort of a win-win for me. They just recently moved to New York, but it's funny because they'll come back to Seattle and they'll play four shows around the Northwest. So they still have all their friends here. They come back to do various jobs here. They've all been employed here, so they'll come back to do these contract gigs. And they are playing the Block Party as well.
That's Iska Daff, and they've just moved away from Seattle. Now here comes this band with a name I like, Car Seat Headrest.
Car Seat Headrest is the project of a gentleman named Will Toledo. He's put out probably 12 albums, lo-fi punk records.
The song's called Fill in the Blank.
You have no right to be depressed. You haven't tried hard enough.
You're into it.
I love it. I can identify with this with these lyrics. Self-deprecation. I'm a fan of indie rock music, but indie rock music that has lyrics like this, I think, is amazing.
I like there's a little depression, but there's some hope because there's self-awareness there.
Who is not depressed in the Northwest? At least a part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Just kind of fight your way through it.
You got that's it. There's this try again. Nobody wants to cause you pain.
All right.
You know, but there's well it hurts. I respect that. With Marco Collins, we have time for one more band playing
yes.
at the Capitol Hill Block Party. Who you got?
This woman, her name is Jess Moni. One word, J-U-S-M-O-N-I, and I saw her get up on stage and just knock the entire place out because her pipes are just incredible.
I'd rather go under with you. Take my hand, explore this deep blue. Go ahead and rock on my way.
But the thing that I find interesting about her is the production that she's working with is all sort of a very surreal hip-hop. It's, you know, the beats are there with this strange sort of dreamy music floating around. And it kind of reminds me of even what Bjork is doing these days. It's not so much about the hook. It's about the feeling.
That was DJ Marco Collins telling you which bands he'll be watching at the Capitol Hill Block Party this weekend. He was talking to Bill Radke. The festival starts tomorrow and runs through Sunday. We're tweeting out a link to the schedule now at KUOW. It's The Record, and I'm Deborah Wong. Thank you for listening.